Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Midlife and Exorcising Spirits, a paranormal women's fiction novel by Leona Knight, narrated by Kitty Hendricks. Chapter 1. Beads of sweat tickled my skin as my heart walloped and I sucked in huge gasping breaths. I couldn't fight the shame of how far I let myself go. You have to understand, I was a martial artist. I prided myself on my ability to kick butt and take names if I had to. It filled me with confidence, especially when I used my moves on some blood-drinking scumbag who attacked me and Gawain when we first met. So to realize how sluggish-limbed I had become was not a pleasant moment for me. My body was rusty as old metal left out in the rain. If I had entered myself into a taekwondo competition, the other black belts would have had my backside on the mat more times than I could count, if I were going by pure physical strength and stamina. But I possess more than just a few martial arts moves. I had the power of runic magic on my side. I could conjure the wind and fire should I need it in a fight. Not that I would ever use magic during a competition. However, even with the use of magic, my opponent was determined to fight me until I dropped dead from exhaustion, and the slave driver helping him do this just watched with unsympathetic eyes. My opponent's movements were swifter than anything I've seen before, and little by little he was ramping up the speed to where his knuckles barely grazed my cheek as I dashed out of the way. Before I could say surrender, his hooved feet kicked up the wind, blowing my unnatural reddish bangs about, causing me to stagger. But this was perfect. For the first time since our fight began, my opponent's back faced me to perform that horse kick, and I took the only opening I had since this fight started and ran at him to execute the jiu-jitsu grappling move my slave driver had taught me. However, my hooved adversary whooshed around me, taking me in a hold I couldn't break. Damn it! You almost had me, Miss Rose. My opponent was a man who wasn't truly a man. He was a satyr, with long, dark red and black highlighted hair, and black horns that looked like he could hook you on one of those things and go fishing with you as his bait. His face was symmetrical and handsome, nose sharp, and lips that settled in a way that made him look as though he was plotting something every second of the day. Gone was the gray, shaggy mop which covered his blood-red eyes. He even began dressing differently. Gone was the butler attire. His pants were long and loose and black with silver trim with many silver buttons and straps, like something you would see at a store specializing in Gothic attire. His pants hung low at the waist, exposing his hips, where the black fur sparsely hugged his figure. And yet he wore no shirt over his bare, thinly haired chest. I wondered what he looked like without his pants on. Was the entire bottom half of his body that dark fur? Ugh, I must be so lonely. The corner of his lips curled as if he could read my increasingly lewd thoughts. You should have broken out by now, Miss Rose. He chuckled a little, which made me fight harder to get out of his grip. I don't need you to tell me that, Magnus. I groaned. Cadmus, the slave driver, left his place at the window nook in this vast training hall and walked along the bamboo floor until he faced me. His blonde hair was growing out, and he could no longer just run his fingers through the strands to smooth it back and have it behave. He wasn't as, how should I put it, as delicate and cunning-looking as Magnus, but he was handsome nonetheless. He was bigger, more brutish-looking, and his face more angled, and the scar on his lips amplified his attractiveness, not distract. But then again, I love scars and blemishes. There was just something about imperfections that made someone more beautiful to me. Take your hand to the left, and bring it up in front of your face so you are facing your palm. Rotate your wrist clockwise so that your thumb is pointing towards your face. Now thrust it downward. I did just as instructed and broke free of Magnus's grip. Good. That's all for today. Cadmus's voice echoed in the thinly decorated space. According to Cadmus, Every house had a training space like his, even if they all looked different. His training hall looked like a Japanese dojo. Mine was a strange mixture. I had the bamboo flooring, perhaps for my taekwondo influence, but the walls were a light stone glittering with blue geode crystals embedded, and vines snaked about the ramparts and stretched toward the domed glass ceiling. Some nights I visited this room when the moon was high and cast a light inside like a dazzling stage. While Cadmus's training hall had weapons adorning the walls, perhaps my house knew I would rely on my runes in battle. If I needed a weapon, I could easily mutate it into existence. The same was true for Percy, who also had no weapons on his cobbled stone walls. Castor's training hall was just used to store all the little gadgets he put together using magic. And Judy's hall looked like a big jungle gym. Just what I'd expect from 9-year-olds.
I think I can give it one more go, I puffed before getting into another fighting stance.
Try casting, Magnus ordered, with his arms crossed over his not-at-all-sweaty chest. Before my training, whenever I needed my runes, they would fly from the pouch to aid me in battle and form a protective circle around me. Both Magnus and Cadmus informed me that this was because I had no control over them, and it was draining my mana. So, one of the first things I learned was controlling the use of my mana in a fight. But that also meant I had to call a rune to cast what I needed, and now none of them responded to me. I flicked my hand again. Nothing.
You most certainly cannot go on. You've used up your mana because you rely too heavily on casting, Magnus scolded. You should build up enough mana before using more powerful spells, he said, referring to when the sparring match began. It was true. My openings to a fight had all been magic attacks before settling on the physical. My goal was always to start strong, but maybe that was the wrong approach.
How am I supposed to know when I have enough and when I don't? I shrugged.
Think of it as you do physical labor. Right now you are breathing heavy and out of breath, which is a sign of both your mana and stamina depleting. If you only cast spells at me, you would feel the same exertion.
He's right, Cadmus chimed in. You gotta find a balance. Cast too much, and you can't fight when you need to. Fight too much, and you can't cast when needed. The blonde began picking up his gear. The training session truly was over. I'll prepare your lunch. Magnus began walking toward the door. Today it's chicken Caesar lettuce wraps and blackened shrimp bowl with cauliflower rice.
I've noticed that most of my meals have been low-carb lately.
I placed my hands on my hips. I didn't mind it at all. It was what I needed. Not only was I feeling a little lighter, but my magic was getting stronger. Yes, I want those extra pounds off, and it will aid in building stamina. We make the food from scratch, which also helps. No more prepackaged junk for you.
And with that, Magnus took himself and that crafty smile of his and left Cadmus and me alone.
I stared at the calluses forming on my hands. I needed to get stronger. Unfortunately, I was a bit of a perfectionist, and every single mistake weighed on me more than I cared to admit. But there was also a Damocles swinging above my head. Training wasn't just for fun or exercise. I had 6 weeks left to pass the 7 magic trials, or face certain death.
Chapter 2 For the past few days, Cadmus took time off of his own training to help me out. Despite him telling me and the other 12 mages here that he would leave us all behind if he had to. Except for Castor, Percy, and Judy, I didn't know how far the other mages were in their trials. I just knew that Cadmus had passed his first trial with flying colors, and he hadn't spoken about it since. I watched him grab his gear and stuff it into the brown duffel bag he brought over and fling it over his bare, sweaty, broad back.
You always head home straight away after training. You could use my bath. I even have a shower now in a few of the bathrooms, I said, extending the hospitality. Cadmus and I barely spoke to each other outside of training.
After finding out from Magnus that it was possible to take a group into the trials, I asked Cadmus to join me and Percy in taking the kids through the first trial, in the hope we could pass them together. He didn't give me an answer, so I assumed that was a solid no. But he still came over every day on time to teach me grappling and throwing moves. "It's better if I left. I didn't bring any clean clothes," he said, heading out of the room.
"Well, next time bring some extra clothes," I said, following him out.
Cadmus chuckled. "It'll be better if I go home, Suki, especially with you looking like this." He reached out to me, his large hand caressing my cheek. My thoughts fell on that moment when he told me I was his fated one. His sudden confession threw me for such a loop that even now his words seemed like he said it in a dream. I backed away when he lingered too long.
"What makes you think your husband is in danger?" Cadmus spat, leading the way down my expansive hallway. "What if he planned to fake his death?"
"Please stop," I groaned. "This won't get you any points."
"See?" he said with a smirk on his lips. "We can't be friends," he said, referring to one of our earlier conversations.
He wanted to spend time alone by the lake, and I felt the need to stress, out of sheer panic, my stance on maintaining a friendship, to which he replied with how we couldn't be friends.
"We can, if you weren't hitting on me."
"I didn't hide anything from you. I told you what I wanted."
"You said you didn't love me."
"I don't." Cadmus finally stopped just before reaching the living room. "That doesn't mean I can't fall in love with you."
I thought his confession would be a one-and-done sort of thing, so much so that I never really thought I had to turn him down, but now I tried to search for the right words until I just stopped overthinking it and said my piece.
"4 months. That's how long I was into my pregnancy during the accident."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"I grew up an orphan, and for a long time I've only had Mia, my sister. Then I met Gawain, and he became a part of my small makeshift family. And finding out that we were going to have a family of our own was..." There were no words. "The day Gawain died, I didn't just lose a husband. I lost my entire family that day. Now, with even Mia gone, the only thing I have besides Castor is the shred of hope that Gawain is alive somewhere out there. I'm just not ready to move on. I'm sorry."
"If he is alive, then where do you think he could be?"
Cadmus replied, but he didn't sound angry.
"I'm not trying to pick a fight with you. I'm curious."
"I heard footsteps right before I passed out at the funeral home and woke up in the hospital. No one knew how I had gotten outside. They say his body burned in the fire, but they wouldn't let me see him."
"You think he saved you?"
"I don't know," I shrugged. "But I heard his voice in my mind telling me to run before the explosion. I've always believed the one who attacked the place stole his body, but everyone thought I had lost my mind because of the grief."
Cadmus didn't say another word to me. He just turned and continued walking until he let himself out. The wet crunch and smell of corn chips and salsa filled the entire living room. Fergus lounged on the sofa, his bare feet hanging over the edge. He littered the coffee table in front of him with junk. Several party-sized bags of chips, different salsa and cheese dips, boxes of chocolates, empty Halloween bags of candy bars, and a half-eaten birthday cake. I wish I could say this scene was new to me, but it wasn't. Fergus was practically eating me out of house and home, if he could eat me out of house and home. But really, the man could put it down. He ate enough food for 5 people without breaking a sweat, and he practically ate all day long. I was convinced he had a second or third stomach somewhere in that body of his. But according to him, dragons had a fast metabolism and digested food rather quickly. And apparently, this is why you won't come across a fat dragon. Talk about green with envy.
"Is it possible to get a TV in here?"
he finally asked, his voice carrying a lazy tune.
I have no idea, but if Agnes can have a Lambo, I see no reason I can't have a TV. Talk to Mags and get us one. There's only so much my imagination can do.
Will do, I said. But I wondered if we could even watch anything here. It wasn't as if we could get internet or cable.
Where is all this food coming from? I looked over the spread. It wasn't like he was leaving the Vale to load up.
I remembered Magnus mentioning something about other servants. Did they bring the snacks and a whole birthday cake for Fergus?
I saw some gnomes in the kitchen, transporting carts of food from a portal in there.
Really? I exclaimed. Gnomes? Real live gnomes. Like the Keebler elf?
Fergus laughed. I sometimes forget how you knew nothing about the supernatural world. They could still be in there if you want to see them.
Real live gnomes? I said again, perking up. Since that gloomy conversation with Cadmus, seeing a bunch of little gnomes was just the pickup I needed.
How long have you been here before me? His brow creased.
This place is a freaking massive maze that just keeps shifting about the stronger I become. 2 days ago, I was lost for an entire hour trying to find my room. I think Magnus was getting a kick out of it. He laughed hard at me, and I let him laugh at my back. I was on a new mission to find the kitchens and see these gnomes with my own eyes.
Chapter 3.
It must have taken me a good 30 minutes to even find the kitchen, and calling this place a kitchen was an understatement. This wasn't the tiny kitchen in my little house, with its only redeeming factor was that it came with a breakfast nook. This kitchen, or kitchens, was as big as my entire house in Arizona. And it also was rather cozy, with its wood-paneled walls and thick-polished cabinets, tables, and chairs. There seemed to be multiple sections of this space. One was the main kitchen, with a massive fireplace and several cooking pots sitting on cast-iron racks nearby. Swept ash covered the ground in front of that fireplace, and its cobblestone walls were gritty with soot. There was also a large stove resembling one of those domed pizza ovens I've always wanted to build in my backyard but never got around to it. Several doors leading elsewhere were closed, but one that led to a little dining hall, filled with a long white cloth-draped table and little chairs low to the ground, remained opened. I couldn't stop myself from gushing at the petite replica of my own dining room. But where are they? I sighed into the vacant space. Did they run off when I came in? Just when I had given up and was going to leave, a small radiance of light shined from down the hall, which perhaps led to the pantry. Oh my God, they're real! The diminutive men and women with fat rosy cheeks were as tall as my ankle, but they worked diligently as they marched out of the oval frame in the wall, carrying what looked like a sack of vegetables and wrapped meat. They dressed oddly normal, regular clothes that you or I would wear, but smaller. Maybe I expected them to be dressed like colorful Amish folk or something. I don't know. I just wasn't expecting one of them to walk into the section of the kitchen I was standing in, dressed in a leather jacket and jeans with sunglasses on. Okay, I expected them to be dressed like the Keebler elves. I'm not going to lie. Old-timey suits and dresses or something. So seeing them this way was throwing me for a loop. A woman entered wearing a navy 3-piece suit and boots with a white apron with sooty handprints over the breasts and a caption that read, "These hands belong to my invisible husband." She pinned her black hair up in intricate braids, and she looked to be a woman in her 30s. She was dishing out a few orders, namely the dishes Magnus had just told me I would have for dinner not too long ago. A timid-looking man walking with her froze in his tracks and pointed up at me.
"The mistress of the estate has finally come to grace us with her presence," the woman turned to address me. Her hands rested on her hips in a proper scolding fashion.
Sorry?
"It's fine. We gnomes are used to mages and their selfishness,"
she waved dismissively.
"I'm Pokey Plumbottom, head chef of the Vale's kitchens."
"I'm
Suki Rose. We know the names of all the mages who reside here, even if we keep our distance. What brings you to the kitchen? Need to make a special request? I'm not allowed to give you heavy carbs. And please, no more food for that dragon.
You're really a gnome?
Of course I am, she perked up.
I thought gnomes work at night.
That's just myths. The nights are just more fun, and it keeps us out of sight of humans. But we can work at any time.
Tell me about your kind.
Like your kind, we come from Ilovar. We love nature and food, and other beings have a tendency to hire us to cater parties and banquets. The veil is one of our largest contract jobs. I took over the position as head chef from Torley Silvertink, and I'm in charge of providing food for all the houses here, she explained with ease. The contract is up if you all die, so try not to do that.
I don't plan on it. What a delight she was. Magnus appeared from one of the rooms, but he didn't seem surprised to see me here. I thought you did all the cooking, I teased.
I do like cooking, and I've already informed you of the other servants.
You didn't say they were gnomes, I replied, still in awe. Are there more?
Not in this kitchen,
he answered in his usual deadpanned manner. Are they stuck here like you?
Who says I'm stuck here? His brow wrinkled slightly. The gnomes are free to come and go as they please. However, they magically cannot speak of this place the same as you. But many workers prefer to live within the veil.
Gnome houses, I exclaimed, like a kid in a candy store. I've always read stories about gnomes and wee folk, and I couldn't believe I was sharing a space with them. It was a reminder that I still hadn't seen all of the veil. After my fight with Elvina, I spent most of my time training, visiting Castor, and researching any loopholes to getting out of these trials. Sadly, my search so far was yielding no results, other than notes scribbled in a journal by a man in the 1500s who claimed he found a way to leave this place and never return. And that was the last entry. So I suppose he was successful or met his end.
Then feel free to explore, Pokey said with a warm smile. The old head chef lives there.
I gasped a little. A thought had come to me. If the gnomes have always worked here, then that means they would know more about Luella. How long do gnomes live? I asked, wondering if they were immortal.
A few hundred years. Our lifespan would never compare to immortals like Magnus, but it's better than humans.
Would you know of a mage named Luella Wright?
No. I took over in the late 1900s, after the incident that wiped out all the mages here.
Late 1900s? How late?
I'm sorry. I forgot humans can be a little precise with dates. It was 1965 when I took over.
It was after your grandmother's trial.
I don't think I would ever get over how young my mother must have been when her mother left for the Vale never to return. So it was after the Elvina incident.
I served a small, insignificant number soon after. Just three mages arrived here, and they all failed the trials, though none of them lived here in this house. Afterward, I did catering work in the human realm for the Dragon Council, and now with your group here, I'm back, Pokey explained. If this Luella lived here, then Torley's place is where you should visit. He lives in the tallest tree in the village. It's split down the middle.
Please, take that lazy glutton of a dragon with you. Make him earn his keep, Magnus said, as if he knew I was heading directly there. Will do.
Chapter 4
Ain't those little suckers cute? Fergus said when I found my way back to the living room. He still lazed on the sofa, with his hand propping up his head, and he was shoving a salsa and cheese-covered corn chip in his mouth. I need a favor. I want to take a tour of the Vale and head east where the forest is. It's where the gnomes live.
You met just a few of them, and now you want to take a look at the entire lot of them?
He groaned sluggishly, and I swore I heard a rumble deep in his throat. You have done nothing since coming here except eat and daydream. What's one little trip to see some gnomes? He heaved a sigh.
Fine. It ain't like I got anything important to do.
He moved at a snail's pace and dusted the crumbs from his black shirt and pants.
So, what's first? The tour or straight to the gnome's place?
Tour first. I want to know how big this little world is, I said, heading toward the door. I don't think I'll ever get over having a dragon man as a ride in this place. Was it excessive or perfect? But then again, is having a dragon for a ride ever excessive? Though I wondered if Fergus needed to be anywhere else. He never asked me about leaving, which made sense, considering this world was perhaps the only place keeping him safe from his council. Fergus, do you have any family? I asked suddenly, while he handed me his shirt. Like wife or kids?
No, he answered nonchalantly. I was just an egg when the Great Conjunction happened.
An egg?
Yeah, he replied with a smile. You think we dragons come out all squishy and human-like? Nah, we need incubating in dragon's fire for a few hundred years while we develop, and then we claw our way out of our scaly shells as little baby dragons. My egg was, unfortunately, one of many that got lost when our worlds collided and ended up on the human side. I never met my parents, and the council raised me as an orphan of the calamity with a bunch of others.
If your world is full of dragons, then how do you take human form? How did you know what we looked like?
It's not the human form we mimic, but that of the Fae, who just so happened to look human, aside from the ears and wings which they use glamour to hide.
He directed me to check out the small markings along the back of his neck.
It's a powerful spell, created by the Seely King, that allows us to shift.
Wait, Seely? That's Fae, right?
Fergus passed me his pants. Yep. The same Fae you mages are trying to off.
Really? So that means Gawain is a Seely Fae? I said, more to myself than him. What would happen to the spell hiding you if we defeat the Seely King?
I don't know. I would think it would be goodbye spell, unless you mages are as powerful as him, which I suppose you would be if you could defeat him.
What's wrong? He passed me his boots. He must have picked up on my hesitation. The only thing I know about this Seely King is that he kicked us out of our home world, and we have to kill him. I know nothing about the context of it all, and I feel like I'm flying blind.
Congrats.
On what? I laughed.
The first step to not being a sheep is questioning the orders of your superiors. If I was told I had to challenge somebody who wiped the floor with potentially thousands of others that came before me, then I would ask some serious questions, too.
The hot magic churned around him, and his wings spread high. He looked majestic and powerful, and he burped out a corn chip. I climbed on, keeping his clothes bundled onto my lap, and my stomach lurched when we took off. We glided around the various estates until we saw the same murky shadows which signaled the end of the world. We circled around, the sun in my eyes, until our backs faced the glow, and we turned toward a thick forest and a beautiful waterfall, which stretched from nowhere and led to the lake that healed me. Nestled within the dense forest was a small town. "I think I can see the little lights of a village. This must be it," I said, laughing. "But I don't see any place to land."
"I haven't done this in a while,"
Fergus's deep voice thundered, but it carried excitement. "What?" I meant to ask more, but the heat and fire licked at my skin, surrounding me, and the tuft of fur I held onto slipped from my grasp, and he left me freaking free-falling. Screaming and flailing, I was too close to hitting the ground when I stopped panicking to call my runes to my side. But before I could utter the words to save myself, I landed in Fergus's muscular arms. He laughed like a madman, and I shrieked like a crazy woman. "Are you out of your mind? Don't just shift mid-flight with me on you."
There was no other place to land. He put me down gently, and I didn't give a damn if he had walked around naked. But he picked his scattered clothes off the forest floor and got dressed.
"Please warn me the next time."
"Come on, admit it. It was fun." My lips curled when his did. "Actually, it was." I giggled.
happy to be alive and pee-stained free. It wouldn't have been fun for anyone if I peed on you. We didn't have to walk for long when we entered the small village. Thankfully, everything was at the base of the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?